are certain people, you know, I watch every once in a while, be they artists, filmmakers, writers, every once in a while, I try to listen for that genius, you know? When someone talks and all of a sudden your ear turns and you're like, what did they just say?
Huh?
Like, whoa, wait a minute. New concepts.
Was that an original thought?
Yeah, I think I don't know if most people can tell the difference between someone who sounds smart and someone who's just saying something that's blowing your fucking mind. I don't think that a lot of people have that ability because, unfortunately, you kind of have to be smart to understand that difference.
Or at least be exposed to enough smartitude.
Yeah, well,
to, you know, to pick it out.
Look, I'm not saying you have to be as smart as the people who say it. It's just kind of the same way that if you're an art
connoisseur, yeah,
you've seen a lot of paintings, you know what you're fucking looking for.
Yeah.
The first time you see a painting, you'll be wowed by it, even though I might look at a painting and see all of its flies.
Yeah, the first time you hear or see a work of genius, you probably think it's just weird. Doesn't fit in, odd.
I
stands out in a weird
way.
I
don't think it can be a work of genius and it not have elicit some improper reaction in people.
Or at least total originality. Genius is a debatable term, but completely original.
I think that one of the interesting, and here's another writer whose story always intrigued me, you know, because here was a man who kind of disdained the very popularity that he got. I'm talking about J.D. Salinger from... And the only book that he's published so far, although there may be books posthumously that we're going to receive, but he...
The Vault.
He felt, actually, that the fact that he became popular was a sign that he was a hack. Because I think that he knew that if something... Because the whole thing is that the Catch in the Rye, like, he thought he was writing something totally original, totally inside of him. And when everybody was like, hey, that's exactly how I felt.
Well, wasn't his point a little bit more subtle than that? It wasn't the fact that he became popular that proved he was always a hack. I think it was more along the lines of, now that he is popular, how could anything he produces from that point forward
hackish? That was never a concern with him.
Well, then why did he put everything in a vault? You have to ask those questions.
I've read a lot about it, and I've watched several movies about this, and I think that the reason that he did it is because there are few writers who take their writing as seriously as he did. Like, a good example is that one of his friendships with a fellow writer and an editor who worked for Cosmopolitan before Cosmo was... you know, a girly magazine. You know, it used to have serious literature, short story magazines. That kind
I
of
read
stuff.
It for the articles.
It used to be like The New Yorker, if you can believe that shit. Cosmopolitan magazine.
Or Playboy.
Believe that shit. Anyways, maybe it can be again, girls. Hey, you want to fucking break that glass ceiling? Yeah. Anyways.
Weird bedroom tricks.
So he basically published a story in Cosmopolitan. He's told his friend, listen, I'm very... specific about what you're going to do here. You got to make sure that they don't change one word, not one comma, nowhere, because here was a person who, if you put a comma where they're in his story where he didn't want one to be there, he would be very upset. He would be worried about that comma. This is a person, this is what I'm saying here. So number one, his main concern was always about how his work would be. So eventually the story got published, but unfortunately they changed the title of the story from Scratch a Needle on the Phonograph Record to Blue Harvest. And when his friend told him over a beer, he's like, listen, I got bad news. They changed the title because I'm not the copy editor for the, you know, front magazine.
Don't make the headlines.
Basically, he stormed out of there and he never talked to him again.
Hmm.
Their friendship was destroyed over that issue. So
right.
It gives you like so. You're asking me why would he hide those stories?
No,
because to him, those characters and everything about it is so real that I don't think he could handle seeing the reaction of everyone. Which is why he decided to publish everything after his death.
But no, getting back to the point about being a hack, I don't really understand your statement that because his work was popular, he was therefore a hack.
No, this is how he felt.
You put your...
This is how he felt.
I mean, he's in the best position of anybody to put himself in the mind of the author. He is the author, and he knows that he wrote The Catcher in the Rye
what he didn't want was that he didn't want people identifying with it the way that they did. I think that the response from people to the novel...
Ah, so society made him a hack, even though he didn't feel like a hack.
I think
they
just
treated him like a popular writer.
It's just the fact that everybody was like, oh man, that's exactly how I feel. Like if you wrote an intensely personal novel that felt like I'm the only one in the world who feels like that, that everybody else is a big ass phony, that I'm the only real person in the world, and then meanwhile everybody's like, oh my God, that's how I feel. It invalidates everything about you. The problem was that Catcher in the Rye was too personal. Halden Caulfield is J.D. Salinger. So when people were saying things like about Caulfield, they were saying things about Salinger. So he couldn't take any of the criticism.
He opened
any
up the door too wide.
And there were three people who claimed their murders on his book.
Right, there are not
a lot of people who do that, except for other Bibles. Or,
Different time. You don't hear about books affecting people that much.
Well,
other than
way,
like the bullshit Fifty Shades of Grey kind of. Oh, it's so popular. Everybody's thinking about it in culture, in society. But you don't hear about books really, especially fiction, influencing the way people think so much. Although, there might be an exception there for weird teen vampire fiction. That seems to be pretty pervasive, like in a whole generation.
I would say an example would be Fight Club, where life imitates art, in this example, where Fight Clubs pop up and they...
Oh, but
that's like the whole culture.
That's like a subculture. It wasn't as popular as Catcher in the Rye. No way.
No, but I think that the other thing too is you have to understand, and this is a very this is another theme that I've noticed a lot about writers, is that they come along at a very specific time. They come along at a time when whatever it is that they say resonates with a bunch of people, and I think that. Say with Catcher in the Rye, like the perspective of Holden Caulfield or the perspective of J.D. Salinger is that of a rich kid who rejects the society that he comes from because he thinks that that society is filled with fucking phonies. And I mean, that is as true today as it was back then.
Yeah.
Nothing about that is has changed, but at the time this was something new. This was no one was talking about this kind of thing. It feels old to you and me because we've already lived through a world that has seen and experienced that. But he was saying something that was fresh. The problem is that I mean, how long is something fresh for? So, and I think the intriguing thing about J.D. Salinger is that he has tons of other stuff that's going to be going through the wire. In fact, this year. 2015.
Yeah, the vault's opening up.
The vault's opening up. So,
do you think it's total shit, or do you think it's going to be just as good, or somewhere in between?
You know what? I can't.
Because he lived his life as a recluse.
I've been trying to find some of his short stories, and here's the problem: they're very hard to find because he didn't want them published, and he was embarrassed about his old work. So, a lot of places that published them, as soon as he found out that they were reprints, he would get them to remove them. So, this is an artist who's taking a lot of different approach to his art that some artists would have, which is like, I don't want you seeing this shit.
Can you imagine? I mean, that's such a different problem than today's artists tend to have. I'm sure there's a few people who like him, but it sounds like he wrote because he had to, and it wasn't for other people. But you hear about so many artists who just struggle to make a living, and they want that audience. They'll do anything to get some exposure. Different. It's almost like to be that great, you can't try. It has to be in you.
I forget who said it, but they said that to write a book, which is a very difficult thing, there has to be something inside of you, some demon, some dark element that needs to come out. Otherwise, there would be no way that you would finish such a gargantuan fucking project.
Yeah.
You would just give up on it. So that may not be true for everybody, because maybe somebody can just smash his typewriter until some fucking book comes out. But I mean, people who put some serious thought into writing and who want to provide some new form of narrative or some new dialogue. I think the main issue that we have with most authors is that it's the same old shit. You know, like, let me write the book that other guy wrote in my language, in my voice.
The concept of the great American novel, I think, is probably something that Salinger helped create. And so many people dreamt of, you know, in the workforce, when they retired, they dreamt of writing the great American novel because they felt like they had a story within them, but I don't think they can even come close to achieving that level of influence.
I think
or
that,
greatness.
I think that if you actually...
Just because they wanted it so much.
I don't know if I want to speak as, you know, as though I have some fucking authority with this, because I don't. My first book has sold less than 1,000 copies, so I can't pretend to know the fucking formula.
But you're writing in an age that, you know, not too many people read.
No, that's not
people,
true.
People read short things online, and they video is king.
Video is king. I don't want to necessarily
as we
say
on an audio podcast
people aren't reading, but I think that the key to writing a really great, say, quote unquote American novel, I'll use one example, let's say or a couple examples, Great Gatsby or The Grapes of Wrath. What they're really encapsulating a particular time period, and it's either its apex or its end, or, you know, it's kind of like Gone with the Wind, right? Like the end of the Civil War. You have to set your novel. If you want to write the great American or great Canadian or great wherever the fuck country you're from novel, what you have to do is you have to set it in a time period in that matters. And this is really important. The protagonists can't have anything to do with the events that are occurring around them. And this is why you don't actually see great American novels or great American cinema. It's because now you will have world events in which the protagonists are actually making a difference in those events. And that's bad. That's bad for a story.
Busted.
Yeah, so a bad narrative is one in which the protagonists are so busy trying to alter world events that they don't actually get to be influenced by those world events. Because you and I are, you know, we're not world fucking leaders. We don't deal with those kinds of conflicts. Therefore, it has no real interest in us. They're not human stories. They're literally superhuman stories. It's the only fucking things that people are watching these days or reading about. Superhumans. And I'm like, I can't relate to these people.
Yeah, maybe Catcher in the Rye was writing about a subject that was on the tip of everybody's tongue, but they couldn't articulate it yet.
Well, do you know what it really is about?
Class and social constructs and expectations. Maybe it's about other things. I don't know.
That's part of it. I think the main.
But people
theme...
weren't talking about it at that point. Now everybody's talking about that stuff. So if you tried to write Catcher in the Rye today, it wouldn't have
with
as
those
big
same
of a,
themes. No.
An effect.
The exact same themes. No, it wouldn't have. Which is why, if you ask me, Catcher in the Rye Part 2, is it just as good? And I'm like, of course it can't be, because there's no way he's going to be writing about things that are relevant. He is irrelevant. When he wrote Catcher in the Rye, like part of the 8 pages, or no, sorry, was it 8 pages or the first couple of chapters of Catcher in the Rye were with him when he was on, you know, embarking on the beaches of Normandy in D-Day.
Right.
Okay. That book went places. That book saw things. I mean, J.D. Salinger was also part of the intelligence group that was investigating Nuremberg crimes and all this other kind of stuff. Again, he was an agent during greater world events, and he saw the world through those greater events, and he, not that he had any major impact on it, but just he got to observe it. And I think that that's what made his novel or his work more meaningful, is the fact that he managed to see those things. This is why a lot of great authors have really traumatizing experiences. You know, like, I'm trying to remember, there's this child author that I was researching, oh god damn it, I can't quite remember. He wrote a book called The Three Robbers, whatever. He was a child's author in the 1950s. He has the weirdest fucking name because he came from, I don't want to say France or Germany, he basically came from Tommy Ungerer. Yeah. And he said something interesting.
Three Robbers.
He was a child author for a while, and his children's book are dark
during his childhood.
In his youth, not his childhood. When he was in his 20s and 30s, he worked on children's books.
Oh, I see.
I'll explain why he didn't work for it a long time, but we'll get to that, because I feel like I'm basically doing all kinds of authors right now. What was unique about him is that he felt that children should be traumatized.
Mm.
Like, he lived through the Second World War. He saw the events that had occurred there. And It influenced his work. I mean, he said that he experienced fear, that he would have nightmares all the time, but that for him, fear was good because it meant that you had to overcome fear. And so his books are often about overcoming fear, and he changed the way that children's literature was done, because before him, every child's book was like, oh, look, bunnies and the Disney fucking effect. You know what I mean?
What about the old fairy tales, Brothers Grimm, that sort of thing?
Well,
he might not have been the first, to bring that kind of prose format in a modern time.
Okay, but that's different. See, back in the day, your concept of children is a very new concept. Back in the day, you weren't really children. You were just young slave workers that needed to, you know, like...
get in line.
Yeah. I mean, you would have that natural, you know, loving instinct, but eventually, oh, you're 6 years old, get to the fucking fields, you know what I mean? Like, you have that up until they can talk, or as soon as they can lift a fucking hoe, they're off to work. So the whole concept of childhood and kids' novels and that kind of stuff really developed later on. And even when it did develop, it was still pretty fucking dark. Nobody really thought that this whole idea that kids needed to be sheltered from reality. I mean, do you know what people used to do for entertainment back in fucking... you know, in the 1700s, they'd go see torture. People go see hangings and shit like that, even in the 18th century, 19th century. You're like, oh, let's go see somebody die. Yeah. So you'd see a lot of reality. But let's just say that, okay, so Tommy, I can't pronounce his fucking
name. Ingerer.
His whole thing was that he brought back a bit of that darkness, let's just say.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of one of the covers of his books, The Three Robbers, and there's basically three dudes wearing hats and one huge-ass axe.
Dude, one of his stories has an ogre, a murderous ogre, as the good guy. who?
Classic. Well, wow. Who the hell's a bad guy?
I don't remember. But that is amazing. That is amazing.
That is amazing.
It's just to say that I think that this whole... I think the approach of, hey, we have to traumatize people. We have to... incite a little bit of trauma. I think that's a good tool, especially in art.
It's not a new idea. I think there's a branch of modern psychology that believes the same thing, that some level of stress, of maybe trauma, maybe not trauma, but something to overcome is important in character building. Whether that's true, not true, whether you agree, disagree, it's not an idea that went away. There's certainly that idea floating around today.
Well, my complaint, you know, because we're just having a general discussion about literature, and you were asking me why. I mean, I'm sure that there's great books out there that we're not generally aware of. It's not to say as though all literature is dead. It's just, you know, what is popular now are not good literary tropes.
Well,
that's the real problem. When we're at the stage where we want every story to be life or earth changing, or everything is in the balance and all this other kind of stuff, it makes every story meaningless. It means the characters don't develop. They just have to move the fucking plot forward. And that's boring.
Yeah.
Like, we don't live in a world in which the characters move the stories. It's which the story moves the characters. And that's not an interesting medium anymore, because everything that happens feels predictable to you.
Do you think part of it is the fact that there was a time when if you wanted to be entertained, you had to read a book. And now if you want to be entertained, you're probably watching TV, you're watching a movie. And, well, side question, what percentage of people just in the West get their entertainment from reading? Is it 50%? Is it 20%? Is it 10%? Like, their primary source of entertainment. Yeah, but I know there's some bookworms out there, but if you look at the sheer numbers, I think it might be more in the 10%, 20% range.
I think that again, places some kind of weird view that just because it's written in a book that it's better than any form of entertainment.
There's something different, though. I do think there's something different, because on film, the story has to be visually interesting. Or at least it's much harder to make a purely psychological, introspective kind of personality, character-driven story as interesting as one that's about the outside world, about explosions and, you know, big action sequences and suspense.
Right, but you're creating this weird false equivalency where
no, it's not a false equivalency.
They have to be as entertaining. I can make a movie in which could take place entirely in one room, and I think I could make it a compelling movie.
No, for sure. It's not impossible, and there are some great movies and great TV shows that do just that. But it's a lot easier to write or to sell a movie and to get viewers if it's visually appealing. And that might explain some of our, you know, formulaic stories that dominate our entertainment.
I don't know.
Whereas in the age of books, you had the advantage of people's imagination, and you don't have that leeway. You don't have that tool.
You're partly true, but I think part of it is...
It's just a question.
I think part of it is over romanticism. You know, we romanticize books and be like, oh, it's this, you know, great world of imagination. And when you really read a lot of books, a lot of it is just fucking pure trash. Unadulterated garbage. And it's so rare that you're going to actually read something that's going to hit you and be like, wow, I can't believe what happened to me. Truth is, most writing falls into the entertainment category. Even most of the great writing, I would, you know, that people say, like, this is an amazing book. I'm like, it's just still entertainment at the end of the day. I think movies are, the thing is about movies is they're extremely effective, but they're very short. So the problem with movies is that you can't develop a lot of character and that kind of stuff. This is why I'm actually a bigger fan of TV or good TV series,
a serial kind of
am of movies, because that the part that's almost always missing in movies, especially today, is the human element. I think that the reason why entertainment movies, if somebody was to ask me, why are movies kind of crappier now? Well, the reason why they're crappier is just because they have to appeal to a larger base of people that might not have as much in common. You know, my movie has to do as well here as it does in fucking China or Japan or Vietnam. So, like, the subtle cultural idioms that, you know, you like to talk about that are entertaining to you and I have to be eliminated because they don't export very well. And this is the problem with movies now, is that we're trying to appeal to a global market, but you can't appeal to everyone. This is why, you know, remember when I was saying that as soon as you appeal to a mass of people, it becomes fucking crap? Well, the reason it becomes crap is when you appeal to the masses, then you eliminate all of the room for subtlety or for things that upset you. Like, a good example, actually, is the Sherlock series that was the BBC series starring Benedict Cumberbatch and, I forget what his last name, Freeman or something. I forget what his
Morgan
first name.
Freeman?
No, not Morgan, but it's Martin Freeman. It's close enough. So in the series, you can tell that the authors are gigantic fans of Sherlock Holmes. I know this because I've read many of the stories and I'm very familiar with them, and they basically take those stories and they modernize them. So that's all in good, except for when they start going into pleasing the fan territory. And that's when it fucking goes awry. I can name you a few examples, one of them being like a character who's like this, you know, she works at the morgue or whatever. She's a mousy character that at first Sherlock Holmes treats like shit because that's just the way he is. And of course, that's how he would react. But then throughout the series, because she becomes a fan favorite, they start incorporating her more into it. And then he starts showing her affection that he really shouldn't. And his character becomes weaker as a consequence when you're like, nope. It shouldn't happen in a fucking gazillion years, but you're trying to fucking play to the fans and you made something worse as a consequence. So that's all. Like, movies play to fans because you can sell more tickets when you play to everybody's likes rather than take chances.
Well, yeah. I mean, it defines what... It raises a question. What is great art? Is it art that is the most true that it possibly can be to the artist's vision? Or is it something that's successful in the way that more people watch it and love it? You know, is one type of art better than the other, or is it just a different kind? There's popular art, and then there's maybe that weird esoteric art that you know, maybe J.D. Salinger wished no one had read his book, or those that had just kept it on the DL a little bit more.
Well, I would say,
what is art? What's good art?
I think that to Matt Damon, actually, of all people, had one of the best ideas for how to judge movies, because, like, you know, obviously being a Hollywood celebrity, he knows that the you know, the awards ceremony shit has gone out of control. Like, how there is one every weekend from the month of June up until I think March. Every weekend you were literally going to awards ceremony to pat yourselves on the back for having done something.
And the award for the least appreciated actor of the season. What?
So essentially you have this, I don't know how to describe it, like a kind of cycle of congratulatory, you know, like all they're too busy, you know, patting each other on the back rather than actually doing anything.
So what's Matt Damon's litmus test for
Matt
great
Matt Damon's radar? Litmus test is to say, do an award show every 4 years. Mm. And you do it for like the movies of the past. Because he said, and he's right, that most of the time when you look at Oscar winners, they don't really measure up. Like, it's the runner-up or people who didn't even get the nomination, right, who end up actually being the ones that are remembered.
Like, maybe the distribution initially was poor on a movie, or it got released right before the judges got to see it.
No. But judging the total, movies has less to do with the quality of movies, total, and more to do with how it's actually...
The total reception of a movie. The way it... Not just how many people saw it, but... And not just the initial critical response, but the effect. Like, how many people start quoting that movie and referring back to it and trying to imitate it over the next year or two? I think that's a great plan. It's kind of like the Fields Medal of movies.
It is, because the issue is, let's say you take the Academy Awards as an example. And for a large part, the Academy Awards is all about, you know, let's say certain movie studios have picked already the movies that they want to be Oscar contenders, and then it's their job to try to promote that and to try to get everybody into that whole Oscar feels. I mean, it's garbage. If you have to take a movie already with the knowledge that you want it to win awards, why should it win a fucking award? It shouldn't. It's just a fucking giant scam, because as soon as you have an Academy Award or something, you sell twice as many fucking copies. So it has now a financial incentive and therefore is utter garbage. It can't be a good valuation of like the quality of any work. Like, there is no award that is actually a good indicator, at least let's say in film, for its quality. I'm not saying that's like that in other fields, because I don't know the other awards and the kind of problems maybe they have as well. But all I can tell you is that at least with the movie industry, it is so fucked that it is ridiculous. Like, it's
really
ridiculous.
Like, it's impossible to judge art fairly. It's impossible. Because
so true.
Art can mean something really significant to one person and be offensive to another and just be complete inconsequential nothing to a third person. So how do you judge art? I mean, you can judge scientific papers on or research on an objective basis, and that's the number of citations and links. It's kind of like the PageRank algorithm of Google. How many cross links do you have to this work of art? But art, how are you going to measure how many people like give a little tip of the hat or a nod to a certain movie by trying to imitate it or mentioning it? Or
it's not even just that.
It's
actually
so difficult.
Here, let me give you even one iota of like just the difficulty in making that assessment. So let's say you're either a writer or you're an artist and you're drawing. Let's just say drawing, right? You're drawing something in particular. Perspective, right? For you, living in the 21st century, perspective is no fucking big deal. You can just do it. You've seen it dozens of times. I mean, like, there's almost no piece of art now that doesn't utilize perspective. But damn, son, there was a time where there was no perspective, where everything was really flat.
Yeah.
And we take for granted that kind of artistic, you know, sort of evolution, because we can look at that, and once we see it, we dissect it, and it becomes easy for us. So the people who trailblaze, who make those first initial steps, what is their importance? They're so massive that, like, guys like me, who, you know, how many artistic people do you know? Like, how artistic do I rank in terms of the people that you know that do art stuff?
A definite four.
Okay. Fine.
On a scale of 1 to...
What is your scale? That's a good question.
40.
But the point is, you know, I do quite a bit of art, and I have to stand on the shoulders of giants all the time. I need to use some a few examples to inspire myself. All this other kind of stuff that you fucking take for granted.
In a way, I think it's good that the ceremonies usually have awards for overall success, like a best picture. Then they have the best actor, like individual art performance. Then you have the technical awards, like best, I don't know, cinematography or soundtrack or whatever, score or whatever they call it. In a way, that's good because it shows up front that there's no way you can judge them all equally. It's a team of how many hundreds or thousands of people work on a modern Hollywood movie?
It's crazy.
It's insane. They're all artists, or many of them are artists, but their collective work is something different. And for that matter, how much influence does the director really have? The director plays an important role, but so does the leading cast, and so do the people who work behind the scenes to make every shot
look
great.
This is again why it's very tough when you're talking about a medium that blends as much art as it does business, because there are realities that have to be met. I mean, like the average movie now costs an incredible amount. Or even any other art. Let's go back to, because you know this segment is supposed to focus on literature here, because I want to go back to that.
Literature. The dying art.
It's not dying. You know what? This is the honest truth. It's not dying. All forms go through this. No, it has shrunk. But if you look at it in terms of, if I was to say that in 1999. How many hours a day were people reading words?
Oh, that's different, though.
Hold on. No. That's...
I read a lot of words every day, but they're not all fiction. Most of them are not fiction.
No, okay, all right, but that's fine. You're not reading fiction now, but...
No.
The exercise of reading is now ingrained into you pretty strongly.
Oh, absolutely.
So now all the person needs to do is to take advantage. See, I think that the reason why fiction and all these other kinds of... these mediums haven't been doing so well is just because we've kind of been waiting on these old ideas, these old men to have new fucking thoughts on how to entertain us. And that no one wants to try new ideas. What they want to do is they want to do what's tried and tested, right? Like, why is TV still the number one place for advertising? There are more people on the internet than watching TV, and yet... you can get more advertising money off TV just because it was the old way. People know that it kind of works and everybody's afraid of the future.
Yeah, well, today it's the safe choice. It doesn't mean it'll be the safe choice in 5 years.
But this is exactly what
I'm
saying. It's
initial conditions. It started off one way. And
yeah, the initial.
It's obviously in flux, but it is what it is today.
The reality is that the environment for reading has never been stronger. So the fact that it's not working is just because we haven't been creative enough in presenting this fucking material.
Well, you know what? I've been getting into audiobooks a lot these days. And I think it's fascinating because someone still has to write it. Someone still has to organize
their
thoughts.
It's a piece of writing.
But instead of dropping down to a kind of a lower level protocol of, ink on a page... in order to reproduce it and for me to have the same ink on a different page, the same shapes of letters and so on a different page, and to convert that in my mind back to a voice or something like a voice in order to get the idea, there's kind of a shortcut. There's a faster protocol stack that I can use where someone's just speaking and I get this whole other range of emotion and intonation, and it's actually pretty easy compared to reading. You can do other things. You can ride the subway. You can drive. You can assemble an IKEA shelf or something.
What percentage of those books?
Germany is insane about audiobooks, and I think they're onto something. It's starting in North America.
What percentage of those books are read by the authors?
I don't know. I'm on my fifth or sixth book already, and probably two were read by the original
authors. Okay, see, but this is the reason why, because you were talking about, look, the way in which you absorb media, okay, is largely dependent on the person who, because writing is it's a varied medium, so you can have someone who's really great at writing a book, not so great at fucking reading it.
Absolutely, yeah.
So this is why the advantage, I guess, of the new multimedia world is that I could write a book tomorrow. I could be a great writer and not a great orator, and it would be no problem for me to find someone to reread it in a nice voice and with the right cadence and all this other kind of shit to make my book a success. Look, I'm going back to the point that I was saying before, and Sketchy Magazine is all about this. Like, my new understanding is I had problems selling my book because you were right. The age of reading whole books,
long form is now a classic activity like fencing or horse riding. Yeah,
but you know what? Those kinds of activities always do for a comeback because it's sort of like
they'll never go away.
It's a good example is sort of, I'm sure that once the whole drinking cocktail phase ended, after when Prohibition ended. Essentially, in 1933, I'm sure everybody was like, oh, it'll never be this wild, cocktail-y kind of world again. And then it disappeared for a while, and then it came back in the 70s, and then it disappeared, and then it came back in the, what do you call the tens? I don't know.
The tens?
It's come back now.
The tents.
I mean, everybody's doing cocktail things. So I just realized, hey, books, just as that form, maybe not as popular as other forms, which is why, again, I went to the magazine format. Because my thought is, you know what? Nobody can turn down a motherfucking magazine.
Magazine is amazing as a format.
It's a fucking amazing
kind of thing. Because, you know, you can carry it anywhere. Works great in the can. You don't have to be embarrassed about bringing a magazine into the can. Or reading it on the subway. Or just keeping it in your bag or whatever you want to do with it. It's full of short, to the point, sweet, funny, sometimes, articles. And, you know, it's like a recipe of all kinds of different ingredients. But the cool thing is, it's like a cake, right? You have the cake part, you have the icing, you have the stuff on top, you have all kinds of different flavors. And you know that the next cake you're going to eat, you know, in the next month or two or three, whenever the next edition comes out, is going to be great, but it's going to have slightly different icing. It's going to have slightly different ingredients, maybe a different fruit on top. So it's short enough to just be bite-sized.
That's digestible.
It's digestible. Yeah. It's funny. It's not a huge commitment of time. It's fantastic. It's kind of like what the podcast is to long-form, long-form
Well, the audiobooks. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean,
it's good.
Audiobooks are great, but for, let's say, a person who's doing, you know, having a commute, they want a 1 hour fucking
one
segment.
Hour is like magic.
You know that Shakespeare invented the knock knock joke?
What?
Here's okay, so this knock, is knock. Because this is what I love, we're still on topic, because this is a literature like show.
Literature.
Here's what you have to understand about Shakespeare. This is very fucking important because it relates to a lot of what I talk about when I talk about literature, which is Shakespeare was, when he spoke and when he wrote, it was common people parlance, okay? Thou. You know, that was kind of like saying yo, okay? I know that for you and I, that it all sounds like really fucking fancy, but that was, they were just talking schmack back in the day, you know? Like,
that was their jive, man.
Like,
that was
Shakespeare,
their jive.
Shakespeare was, like, his plays were really popular. They were so popular, in fact, that not only did he build his own theater, at one point when the taxes for that theater became too high, he literally moved it from one side of the city to another side of the city.
What a cheapskate.
To give you an idea of just like how much money is flowing here. So, I mean, he's a Gilbert, you know, like a Gilbert and Sullivan kind of guy. You know, he's writing for the common people of the fucking time, and he's hitting all the right notes. So get it out of your brain that he's writing some kind of like, oh, it's all high society fancy shit. No, he's, most of his plays, most of them, are really just kind of common stuff. I mean, like, there's lots of comedies, even though there are many dramas. For the most part, he was just trying to appeal to the common people. So, really, you can't make art unless, to some degree, you are really trying to appeal to common folks. It's just that the difference between the stuff that's, you know, really lasts and the stuff that doesn't is that, you know, like, let's say the great thing about Shakespeare is there's so many things in our own vocabulary or our own speech that we talk about, like, you know, Jealousy is a Green-Eyed Monster, or oh God, why is it failing me now? I'm trying to think about all the Shakespearean kind of idioms that you use. Damn it. Well, I can't think of any because my partner is typing on a telephone. That's very distracting.
Wait, what are we talking about?
Can't do that. Are you answering emails?
It's a fellow of infinite jest.
Yeah. It's very distracting. And
immaculate fancy. But I'm misquoting Shakespeare here. Really badly. Really poorly.
But Shakespeare has, I mean, like the Shakespeare-isms that we use in our own vocabulary is quite vast, let's just say. But I just want people to forget this idea that Shakespeare is this unreachable, you know, kind of snooty Victorian guy. It's just that the language that he spoke doesn't sound the way that you talk these days, which is why I think that Shakespeare every once in a while needs to be revisited by talented authors who need to write it for modern audiences.
Oh, have you ever seen the videos of Ian McKellen reading Shakespeare
the way that it was originally supposed to be?
Well, I mean, it's all interpretation.
Sure,
but, of course. But his interpretation, speaking to other actors, like drama students.
I have not seen these.
Insane. Spot on.
Well, do you know what Orson Welles said? That he said that Shakespeare was best read by people who had never heard anyone else read Shakespeare. Because the problem that they make when they read Shakespeare is a lot of the time they try to imitate people who've read Shakespeare, and that is a huge mistake.
No, and I think Ian McKellen has such a good grasp of the subject and the style of speaking that he's able to spot. He's not only able to read it in that kind of iambic pentameter kind of rhythm, but he knows exactly by the writing when to deviate from it and when to accentuate and prolong certain syllables. And it makes so much sense when he's reading it. It just sounds like real people talking.
It's why you can't have people who don't know what they're talking about reading it, because if you take a lot of what Shakespeare writes about, even if the language doesn't seem understandable to you, is about the way in which it's delivered. If a person understands what they're talking about, even though if I say something in a strange language, if I say it in a way that's recognizable, then it takes away a lot of the mystery of what's being said. And I think that's the problem. A lot of the time people who are reading Shakespeare, they're like, what the fuck does this mean? And, you know, they'll skip over it or whatever, and they don't know that really, if you understood what the fuck this meant, even if you had to replace the word or say it in a specific way that, or with an intonation that made it clear that you were saying it, a word in an aggressive fashion, in a contrary fashion, in a frustrated fashion, you know, like the emotion that comes with words that you can't teach easily. Mm-hmm. And this is probably the problem with a lot of like Shakespearean plays, is that nobody taught you what the emotions were or what really was supposed to happen. Everybody was just so focused on getting the words right.
And
I was like, you know what? The words are a bit less important than what the fuck is happening.
Yeah.
Really. Like, focus on that.
No, a true master would have that whole base of knowledge of what those words are and what they mean, but enough to automatically speak that language and be able to emote at the same time. That seems like the really challenging part.
Well, let's talk about, because here's what's interesting. Let's take one of my favorite Shakespeare plays, which is Othello. I like this play for a couple of reasons. One is it was one of those plays in which the main actor had to be fucking black. So this is one of those rare plays that, it just garners controversy because your main actor is already
in blackface.
No, if you
check out.
I'm sure that most or many productions have been done in blackface, but blackface, terrible. Let me tell you something, is a bit of a recent kind of or American phenomenon. Okay, there have been legitimate individuals in theater that were, you know, darker than what color would you assign us? Sickly pink. I don't know what our color is,
but German chicken sausage white.
But Othello is interesting because he's a guy who's an outsider, who is in a society in which he's gained respect and status, and now he falls in love with essentially the hottest fucking chick in town, if you want. And there's a man who really despises him, Iago, who pretends to be his friend, and throughout the entire play convinces him that his wife is cheating on him, and he basically kills his wife and blah, blah, blah. And he essentially slowly takes a man, he destroys him with his own jealousy and his own, paranoia or whatever. But it's the manner in which this whole kind of thing plays out, which I find interesting. But again, if you were to say, hey, I want to make a movie about a guy who kills everyone he cares about because there's a dude who's jealous of him. I mean, who the fuck would make this nowadays? Nobody in their right minds.
No, yeah. I mean, can you write something like a Shakespearean play today? Probably not.
Well, you can't.
It would be kind of indistinguishable.
You can write the play. I'm just saying you can't make the movie. I mean, or you can't decide that you're going to make
it. Would anyone go see it?
That's a good question. I still think that there's room for it. I think any time when you're sort of like, oh man, things suck right now, and I'm like, that is the biggest opportunity to make something great. Look, if you were living in a time in which there were literary geniuses fucking taking center stage, you should give up. You know, you're not going to be one of them.
Yeah.
You're done. But if there's nobody up there, guess what, fucking idiot? That could be you. It could be you up there. If we need giants, then fucking let giants come forward. I think that the times where we are the most hungry for it is the most exciting time for it, because somebody will appear. I don't know who it is, but somebody will appear, then we're going to stand up and be like, who is this motherfucker? And we need to listen to this person. I'm trying to be gender neutral. I mean, I don't know who the fuck it's going to be. I hope they come soon. You know what I mean? I'm just dying for something.
Well, do you think they take the form of a playwright or a traditional author? Or would they be more of, just throwing names out there, directors like Nolan or Tarantino, who write movies that everybody want to watch?
I think that maybe even these guys are part of a media that is so old and busted that you and I haven't even imagined what the future of entertainment might be. Look,
true.
I mean, we're right at the cusp of fucking holograms. I don't know what that means, man. Like, if all of a sudden
holograms.
Like, did you see that there's this movie that's going to be out there that looks like as if it's filmed entirely in Skype? Did you see it?
No.
Give me that. Give me that right now. Give me that.
No. It's cool, man.
No. Give me that.
Is that like a found footage kind of movie?
Okay, it's kind of like Blair Witch Project. You know, where
found
it's like
footage.
It's
lame.
It's kind of like a whole bunch of kids are like, hey, they're talking on Skype, but all of a sudden something's happening, and it's all like, oh my God, I'm live watching somebody being murdered. Ah.
All my friends are online, and I can't interact with them physically.
Okay, and then the whole thing about the movie was they were trying to say, this is a new kind of movie, no one's ever done this. I mean, it's new and not new in the really horrible way.
Debatable, bro.
It's new in the bad debatable. Way. Debatable. It's new in the bad way.
It's new in a terrible terrible way.
But we always have to experiment with those kinds of things.
Experimentation is good.
So what if
claims that you're making something
original?
No, but
what if tomorrow somebody said,
bad.
I'm doing performance art,
mm-hmm.
and I'm doing it as a fucking live YouTube event. Now you have an event where something really could happen, like where you perform some crazy, you know, live art piece. I don't know what. The point is, I mean, maybe I'm a little disappointed that the biggest or most impressive things that people are doing is putting cat videos up.
Yeah.
But we've built a system right now where the loudest and stupidest voices can be the first ones heard. So we shouldn't be surprised where the stupidest things
well,
are the
we
ones
know,
that,
I mean, have we learned
up.
Nothing from the whole meme movement, the idea of a meme? forwarded by Richard Dawkins, that there are certain ideas and certain bits of culture that don't succeed on their own merit. They succeed because they latch onto our weird viral primitive brain communication instincts, and they make us want to share them even though we hate them. Yeah. Like the whole viral clickbait kind of articles, awful, terrible. And even major news outlets are copying that writing style.
They have no choice.
Here's one thing the Bank of Switzerland will shock you with. What they did next will surprise you.
They have no choice because
it's so dumb.
They're desperate.
To compete because all the traffic's going elsewhere.
Yeah, they're desperate to compete because here's the thing. I mean, like, there used to be a time where, again, in the publishing world or in, say, TV land, people, like a very few individual, could control it and say, this is what's good and this is what's bad.
Yeah.
And it had some advantages. Like, for instance, it got rid of a lot of crap. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which
mm-hmm.
is now mostly what you have to wade through. But the advantage of the fact that it's not a bunch of fucking similar dudes making all the decisions is that the really creative, imaginative stuff can be created. I think the difference is that stuff, we're going to only be aware of it later. Like, a good example is some of the funniest and best videos that I've ever seen on YouTube. I found them 5 years after they were made.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is where we're at. The greatest show or the greatest fucking thing has probably already been made. And it's going to take so long because we have to wade through. I mean, like, every day, 48 hours of hundreds and hundreds of hours get made every day?
Oh, like, it's on YouTube, like a century every day or something.
Like, it's ridiculous. Yeah. How much of it is crap?
It's like, kind of like the whole Matt Damon saying, you know, true art should be judged over time.
Don't make it a saying. Maybe four years or so. We're paraphrasing.
Right.
But the idea I thought was solid.
It's a solid idea.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you have to get rid of the short-term, like, Hollywood glitz kind of shows, because people like those too. But...
Well, you can't, because people like them. You can't get rid of them. That's the truth. You just can't.
You don't have to, and you can't. But it doesn't mean you can't do a real art retrospective every 5 years, 4 years, whatever. It's worth it.
Well, where we can at least judge the effect, because it's kind of... You know, there are two reasons why I think you need to give something time. And the first one is that, like we just discussed, you know, like, there's so much fucking crap, you don't know whether or not it's good. But the other reason, too, is that if tomorrow somebody wrote the most brilliant fucking book in the world, no one is going to want to be the first person to say that it's brilliant. And that, I think, is the reason why it takes time. Because it also takes the bravery of the people who read it to step forward and say, this is important. Because, you know, you're kind of putting yourself a little bit out there when you do that.
Yeah. That was crazy. We just talked about art for an hour. That was awesome.
Yeah. We're going to cut it up.
Slice and dice.
Add a little music.
Spice of life.
Thank you.